On this week's 51%, a researcher looks into fixing mutated genes linked to breast cancer, and we bring you a conversation with the CEO of the Ms. Foundation for Women.
I think we just need to own the word feminism, and we need to then own the values and the definition behind it.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. About 1 in 8 American women will be diagnosed with breast cancer. Some of the most aggressive forms come from an inherited gene mutation. Using new visualizing technology, a Virginia researcher is on the hunt for better treatments for those inherited aggressive forms of cancer. Allison Quantz reports.
In 2013, actress Angelina Jolie made headlines talking about her preventative double mastectomy.
Bottom of the hour now, it is the bombshell announcement that sent ripples through Hollywood and really across the world today. Angelina Jolie revealing in this New York Times opinion piece that earlier this year, she had not just one, but both of her breasts removed.
And Jolie wrote in the New York Times op-ed, "The truth is, I carry a faulty gene, BRCA1, which sharply increases my risk of developing breast cancer and ovarian cancer." Now, you, like me, might read this and think BRCA genes, BRCA genes, are bad genes that you don't want to show up on a genetic test. But that's not quite right. It turns out we all have BRCA1 genes, and they actually help fight cancer.
It's sort of a protective mechanism, a suppressor. It protects cells from becoming cancerous.
This is Deborah Kelly, a professor of Virginia Tech's Carilion Research Institute. To understand her work, let's go back to the basics. DNA are the instructions for making cells. If there's a mistake in the DNA, think like a typo, then the cells that get made from following those instructions might have some mutated parts. Those mutations can cause cancer. Enter BRCA1.
Codes for a protein that's actually doing something to keep cancer at bay in cells.
BRCA1 are DNA instructions that make a special BRCA1 protein. That protein identifies the cancer-causing typos in other DNA and fixes them. It's like a handyman inside your cells. Some people, like Angelina Jolie, inherit a mutated version of BRCA1, which means that BRCA1 protein isn't able to do its handyman job properly, and you get an increased risk of cancer. Dr. Kelly's lab is looking for a way to make mutated BRCA1 work normally again. And it starts with a really, really good picture.
We developed some procedures where we can take cancer cells and then pluck out or remove this BRCA protein and then use math and physics to really bring these things to life in a 3D. We can rotate them around and then see where the problems arise, where things look different.
Kelly found that mutated BRCA1 proteins actually look different than the ones that work normally.
So the protein essentially looks like a clamp. It kind of has like a U sort of shaped. But when the protein is mutated, it has a very different shape and architecture that we can actually see.
Kelly sees those visual signs of mutation as an opportunity for treatment.
So it appears when the protein is mutated, there's an extra bit to it that we can use enzymes to carve away, and the protein can be reinstated to look very much like the normal protein.
Now the lab is testing whether carving away that extra piece means the BRCA1 can go back to doing its job and fighting cancer.
If there's a way in which we can transform it back to its normal state, then it might act normally inside cells.
Kelly's not making any claims of a cancer cure, but if this works, it could be huge.
Women who have breast cancer wake up every day with a clock in their head ticking, tick, tick. Is my cancer going to come back today? Is it going to come back? What's going to happen? We'd like to make it so that women with breast cancer don't wake up with a clock in their head every morning. Who knows what we'll discover?
For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Allison Quantz.
It's been more than 40 years since the Ms. Foundation for Women was formed to help women and girls. Gloria Stein and Patricia Carbine, Letty Cotton Pogrebin, and Marlo Thomas founded it in 1973 with a stated mission to build women's collective power to realize a nation of justice for all. Ms. Foundation CEO Teresa Younger talks with Lauren Schiller of Inflection Point from KALW about how feminism can be a value everyone can share. Younger says her work consists of elevating and amplifying the voices of women and girls across the country.
I've grown up all of my life recognizing that not everybody has a voice, not everybody's voice can be heard, and that it's critical that we take a step forward and in order to have the most progressive and democratic country we can, we have to have as many voices at the table as possible. And I learned that from a very, very early age. I learned that from being a Girl Scout, very young. My father was in the military and we traveled a lot. And he also, you know, lived those values in our household that people's voices needed to be heard. And so, so it's been a long time coming, but to be able to amplify the voices of women, to be able to build a movement and support the movements, and to trust that women know what the answers are in their communities to have the greatest impact in their communities is a very natural place for me to be.
When you started just about 2 years ago, running the organization, I know you traveled quite a bit to hear from the groups that were already being supported by the Ms. Foundation. Could you talk about that?
Sure. So the Ms. Foundation offices are in Brooklyn, New York. And when I started my very first day, I walked into the office, saw these amazing pictures on the wall of the grantees, and looked out the window of the office. And I realized right then and there that the amazing work that was happening, that we were funding to happen, that we were supporting, was taking place on the ground throughout communities throughout the United States. And so I decided that I would do a listening tour. I'd spend my first year on the ground talking to our grantees, talking to friends of the Ms. Foundation, talking to people who knew Gloria and know Gloria and know of her work, and people who didn't know anything about us. And I traveled about 53,000 miles in my first year to places from Albuquerque, New Mexico, to Jacksonville, Florida, to Visalia, California, to Minneapolis, Minnesota, to South Dakota, and sat and listened to people tell me their stories about why they were doing the work they were doing and where their commitment was and where they thought Ms.'s work could be amplified and what they thought we needed to be doing. And it was really an amazing opportunity to just talk with people.
What were some of the biggest opportunities that you identified through that listening tour?
One of the key things that I heard from people, I asked a question in every exchange around feminism. And every time I asked the question around the definition of feminism, people kind of didn't define themselves as a feminist. When I gave a definition of the social, political, and economic equality of all genders as the value of feminism, almost every single time I gave it, people came to the table and said, yes, that defines what I believe in, the social, political, and economic equality of all genders. And so while I was on the ground, while I was talking and listening, I would ask them, and they would say to me, this movement that you're talking about is really many movements. It's not just the women's movement, but really rather the movements that are affecting the lives of women. And we want to be part of it. Whatever it is, we want to be part of making the world a better place. And you found people that were really in this very broad and inclusive and holistic and idealistic state of mind that they really wanted the world to be better. And they really wanted to participate in what that looked like. It, you know, we've succeeded in our society of dividing people up. And so each time I sat with different groups, I would hear slightly different things, but it all amounted to, you don't want me. You meaning the women's movement or meaning the definition of feminism. You know, the trans community would say to me, you know, We're not feeling welcome and safe. Men were saying, you don't want us in this conversation. Young women were saying, you don't understand and you don't want us in this conversation. Women of color were saying, you're not hearing what we have to say. And so what I felt I needed to do and what I heard from people was, we also want a national diversified voice that's talking from a gender lens, that's talking from a women's perspective, to challenge and question what's going on and to lend credibility to conversations. So we were really able to kind of put together a campaign that's talking about feminism as a value, as a social, political, and economic equality of all genders. We're inviting people to be part of that conversation, and we're in the process of expanding the tent so that everybody feels included in the conversation, and challenging us to think bigger and to be bolder in how we are looking at the intersections of the of everybody's lives and the work that we need to do to amplify, to empower, and to celebrate the work that's being done on the grassroots level, so we can really make this a true democracy that really values all of the voices.
Well, I've been wondering lately if the word feminism needs a new brand campaign because of what you just described, where you first you put the word out there and the response is, oh, no, that's not me. And then you explain it and they say, oh, yeah, that is me. But then you still have this issue that it's not, it doesn't feel like it's got ownership by all of these diverse groups.
Yeah, it's funny because people have asked me that very question, which is like, maybe we need a new word. And I don't think we do. I think we just need to own the word feminism, and we need to then own the values and the definition behind it. And then we need to find safe places to allow people to feel comfortable. We can't just assume that everybody's going to feel comfortable with the terminology, but give them room to grow in the terminology of what we're defining. And, you know, really challenge ourselves to have those conversations, to have those discussions, to have that debate, to explain why it doesn't apply to them, which is, you know, when we talk about the language, this inclusive value language that we've put together around this and are talking about, the social, political, and economic equality of all genders, we're finding that that actually is inviting people into the conversation to define feminism as something that they understand, as a strategy that they feel they can work with, as an inclusive way to host a conversation and take action and to build movements.
Will you take us inside one of the organizations that the Ms. Foundation supports that is demonstrating these values at work?
Yeah. So the Ms. Foundation has three key priority areas: health, safety, and economic justice. And so while I was on my listening tour, I was actually able to sit down and visit with our grantees. And one that I really appreciated and enjoyed, particularly because I got to spend so much time with them, was an organization in New Mexico called Young Women United. And Young Women United is a reproductive justice organization based out of New Mexico, and it is geared towards women 35 years of age and younger. And they are about empowering women and parents in their communities to live their lives the way they choose. And it's a very culturally sensitive group. And we drove from Albuquerque, New Mexico, to Roswell, New Mexico, which is about a 3.5-hour drive. And in that drive, I got to spend time with the executive director of this grassroots organization and hear about why she was doing the work she was doing and really create a partnership and a connection and a friendship in our drive, talking about our lives, our similarities, and our differences. And then we arrived in Roswell, New Mexico. This organization, Young Women United, had been helping to organize young parent voices and had been working with a group and promoting legislation that allowed for young parents, particularly young mothers who were pregnant, to leave school, basically develop a Family Medical Leave Act for those young parents so that they could come back to school, do the work, and graduate on time. So the time they spent out didn't mean they got kicked out of school for having a child. So we were going down to celebrate the one-year anniversary of this legislation that had passed in New Mexico and their work around organizing these young parents to testify and organize around this issue that was important to them. The issue had been brought to the organization. And we walked in and the room was filled with young parents, children, members of the school board, and members of the community. And we were waiting and waiting, and in rushes this young woman with a baby on her hip, about a 3-year-old on her hip. And she pulls out her piece of paper and she starts telling us her story. And she says, I'm so sorry that I'm late today, but I want to tell you, this has been an amazing year for me. I graduated from high school with my friends. I married the father of my son. And today I am late because today was my first day of college and I stayed after to speak to my professor. And this little boy on my hip, this is my son, Manuel. And so she proceeded to tell us the story about how she was empowered to step forward and advocate for herself, her education, and for her child. And in coming together, in being able to get to meetings, so the small donations that the Ms. Foundation was able to make to this organization and the support we were able to give them meant that they were able to pay for gas money for parents to actually get to meetings, to actually talk amongst themselves, to figure out strategies that they wanted, allowed for us to help them pay for childcare so that they could fully participate in the meetings that were going on. And this young woman stood there and told her story. And she said to the young parents in the room, you know, I would have never thought of speaking in front of a crowd. And yet now I tell my story as often as possible. I made it to Santa Fe and I testified in front of the legislature about why this legislation was so important. And today I'm standing in front of you telling you must get your education, you must advocate for yourself, and you must advocate for your children. And to all of the adults, other adults in the room, thank you for supporting our decisions and helping us to come up with the solutions that allow us to be the most active citizens in our community. And what is most important about this story is this young woman at 19 is now somebody who understands the value and understands what happens with the state legislature, and she's going to be actively engaged in the democratic process from this moment forward. And that's what we really want to see happen.
The Ms. Foundation's been around since 1973, and you're coming up on its 45th anniversary. What would you like to be celebrating in 2 years?
Wow. you know what I'd really like? I'd really like to see the percentage of dollars going into women and girls funding to be increased. Right now, there's only 7% of annual dollars are going to women and girls, and even less are going to women and girls of color. If there's anything I can do in the next 2 years, it would be to challenge all of us in the funding community to direct more dollars to women and girls, particularly women and girls of color, to be able to do the work that they need to do. We don't see the best strategies that we can see because most nonprofits headed by women of color are scrambling to make sure that they can pay the bills and keep the lights on. And we need them to spend their time on making strategies and developing the strategies to have the greatest impact in their communities. And so by our 45th anniversary, I'd like us, the Ms. Foundation, to have generated more dollars to go out into the field and to continue to advocate for women in leadership at all levels.
Well, it feels like so many of the issues that the Ms. Foundation tackles and that you were working on when you were in Connecticut on the Permanent Commission on the Status of Women, mm-hmm. health, childcare, violence prevention, I mean, even, you know, to the level then of women in leadership for the Ms. Foundation, I feel like we could still be having this conversation since the time that the organization was founded. So what is still troubling you given that reality? I mean, I know things have changed, but
things have changed. I think, you know, it's interesting because I talk oftentimes to some of our longer term activist members, feminists that have started the movement. And I think what we sometimes forget is that no battle is ever truly over. You know, the reality is we will have to continue to have these conversations, discussions, debates. And we need to find the time and the energy to make that happen. But I'm very optimistic because I think because of Title IX, because of Title VII, because of Roe v. Wade, and hopefully its stability within the courts, we have a whole group of men who understand women's rights in a very different way, right? We have a whole group of women in this country who understand what they can do in a very different way. Jobs are not posted in the newspaper for men and for women. Women are no longer told they can't do that, and if they are, then we know the steps to take to make sure that that's not the prohibitor for what they can do. They can serve in the military, they can serve in the legislature. So I think it's not a reality that we are going to think that this conversation is going to be over in 2 years, in 10 years, or in 20 years. Because we are going to have to remember our history so that we don't go back and repeat where we had been. And so we have to keep those conversations open and going. But what's also critical is that the lives of women are not monolithic. And so there are many complexities to the conversations, the successes, and the battles that we still need to face and have an understanding of, you know, where race and gender intersect, where race, age, and gender intersect, where regionality comes into the conversation. All of those conversations can't be resolved overnight, and nor will they be.
Well, you've made strides yourself personally in the intersection of race and gender. When you headed up the ACLU of Connecticut, you were the first African-American and the first woman to head that up. And I'm wondering, was that kind of label, if you will, in your consciousness when you showed up to work on day one? I mean, as far as needing to represent, you know, both things? Or is it just like, I'm here to do the job and that part is really irrelevant?
It's not, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was. I think I did show up. I had grown up in an environment that wasn't racially diverse. So being the one and the only in a room was always something that I anticipated. Being the first was something I never anticipated. But what I recognized is that, you know, there are still opportunities for women of color to be the first in everything we do. What I needed to do was recognize the shoulders by which I was standing on were both those of women and those of people of color, and to make sure that I did them proud in the work that they had done to lay the pavement for me to come forward. I oftentimes talk about the fact that I stand in the shade of trees that I did not plant, and I walk down roads that I did not pave, and I drink from wells that I did not drill. My responsibility where I am now in my life as a 46-year-old Black woman leading a national women's foundation is to make sure that I water the trees and that I relay the pavement and that I maintain the wells so that the next generation that comes after me isn't just a first, nothing is new, but that they understand it didn't just happen that way.
Was speaking up for yourself and others something that you've always known how to do and felt comfortable doing?
Yeah, you know, I always say, like, be careful what you ask for, you know. Don't tell your child to speak up for themselves and then not expect them to.
Yeah, I should remember that.
when I was in second grade, I had a teacher, and I was misbehaving on the playground, and I had a teacher, Mrs. Blackmore, and she walked over to me, and she said to me, I expect more from you than this. And I remember to this day that exchange, right? I just looked up at this woman. It was the first Black teacher I had ever had. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, I'm being watched. People are paying attention and they expect more from me. And I think I carried that through. You know, I think it was only a matter of months later, you know, everything you learn in school, you apply. We used to go to school off base and we were on a bus and the bus driver was driving us back to the base. And he was telling us where we could sit in our seats for whatever reason. I don't even recall why. But he had told us, you know, you have to sit here and you have to sit here. And it seemed to me that all of the children of color were being placed in the back of the bus. And so when we pulled up to the, and he had told me I couldn't talk on the bus and that I needed to be quiet. Of course, I was organizing in the back all the students to kind of say something, and everybody was afraid. They didn't want their parents to get in trouble. When we pulled up to the gate, I remember opening the window and yelling out the window, this bus driver is a racist, and it's not fair what he's doing. The poor military police officer, MP, at the gate didn't know what to do, so he pulled the bus over, and our parents had to come and get us at the gate. And my mom, you know, my mom came to pick us up, and she said, you know, what happened? And I said, well, you know, the bus driver just can't treat people meanly. He's got to be fair. He can't just tell us where we can sit and can't sit. And I think for me, it was about the fairness of the conversation. Why did certain people have to do what he was telling them to do? And so I think early on, I had my voice. I felt like I needed to protect other people with that voice, or at least give voice where people were afraid, and that I would oftentimes challenge authority. And that has always been something that I've done.
That was Teresa Younger, CEO of the Ms. Foundation for Women, speaking with Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller, produced at KALW in San Francisco. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1458.